In this sense, music life is as much propaganda in the non-derogatory sense for a nation as are the other branches of its spiritual, technical, and economic activity. Maybe we can go even further than that and say that music, even more than any other art, offers an opportunity to gauge not only the artistic and cultural level of a given society, but the sociological and economic situation as well. For one thing, music life involves a great many people, whether it be singers gathered in a chorus or players gathered in an orchestra, or whether it be simply the thousands and millions of people who have to participate in music life in order to form the audience for these concerts, without which concerts and performances would have no soil, no sounding board. This goes for any kind of musical activity, from folk music gatherings to the Metropolitan Opera, and from a tribal dance to a philharmonic concert. Therefore, I think our music life constitutes an even more important propaganda for or against us than our endeavors in the field of painting or even of science, where a very high level of achievement can be attained by a relatively small group of individuals whose activity need not necessarily be indicative of the level of the public at large, or at least to a much lesser degree than is music life. Now, it is probably the realization of this fact which has caused a great many people here in the United States to worry considerably about many symptoms of danger to some of the most cherished institutions on the American musical scene. Our leadership in the world of Western democracy, I believe, is no more a political catchword, no more a question. It is a hard historical fact, whether we like it or not. And while we can seriously differ among ourselves as to how we best live up to the responsibilities inherent in this fact, I think almost nobody in this country today escapes it. Nobody can deny that what happens in this country today is watched all over the globe by our friends and our enemies alike. And a ruthless propaganda machine has been at work for many years to point out and exploit the true or imaginary flaws and problems besetting our democratic way of life, waiting to be solved not by a ukase from the top, but by the slow, often agonizingly slow, but healthy way of debate and understanding. There are many fields, of course, in which American superiority, or let's rather call it leadership, is uncontested, except by maybe a fanatical minority of people. We are the richest country in the world. We do have the most and finest iceboxes and automobiles and so on. But we also have the fewest opera companies of any nation in the Western world, and the lowest percentage of serious music on the radio. The New York Philharmonic is less secure financially than a little municipal orchestra somewhere, maybe behind the Iron Curtain. Our young singers are starved for opportunities to sing, and our young concert artists find it hard to find a hall to play in unless they are among the lucky few who land a contract with a big manager in New York. And our young composers hopefully send their scores from publisher to publisher and conductor to conductor, and if they get a performance, it's likely to be the one, the first, and maybe the last. And one young composer told me the other day, you know, the most difficult thing in this country is to get a second job. Well, how does this look with regard to our responsibilities of leadership? At first glance, sad. Now, unfortunately, many of our critics, inside and outside this country, never take the trouble to look real close and to see that, after all, the same standards do not apply here that apply elsewhere. And that over the years, over the decades, we have developed an entirely new set of values and an entirely new social setup. And in order to follow that, let us look once at the position in which the young American artist finds himself today. The economic situation of any musician is, of course, determined by the conditions under which he sells his goods, which means performance. The musician, without the possibility of performing, or in the case of the composer, of being performed, is as useless to himself and the world as a mountain guide is to Holland or a sailor is to Oklahoma. In order to perform profitably, the musician needs listeners, just as the salesman needs customers and the doctor patients. And we shall go a little bit into the intricacies of the relation between the musician and his public. You see, the fact that a pianist has to have a hall to perform and a piano to display his talents, and that an opera singer needs the frame of an opera in order to perform, that the composer must find an orchestra willing and able to play his work, and that all of them cannot dispense with publicity in order to make themselves known and attract attention to their work. All this is part of this particular situation. In addition, a musical performance is only an ephemeral act, clearly defined in time and space, and once it's over, it's over. And you can be wonderful 999 times. If you are bad the 1,000th time, you are as bad as your last performance. Now, we have more and better musical artists today than we ever had before. And every year, as you know, a small army of splendidly trained concert soloists pours out of the gates of our music schools all across the country. Every boat landing in New York City brings one or more musicians from the old world, either famous ones eagerly awaited by our public here, or unknown ones hopefully looking forward to making their career in this land of unlimited opportunity. The creation of good music has grown by leaps and bounds. The community is not even on the map. A few decades ago, today enjoy regular concert series featuring renowned soloists. Pint-sized youngsters are lugging violin cases without fear of being ridiculed by their classmates. And in many an American home, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, Grandpa now smokes a Saturday afternoon pipe to the accompaniment of the Met. Yet, how come we speak about ever-increasing difficulties for our young artists, especially those whose qualifications, for one reason or another, cannot be determined very easily or very readily? Many of our qualified artists find themselves virtually unemployed. I see them walking around 57th Street and 42nd Street in New York, auditioning day after day for manager after manager, hoping, and yet in so many cases, these hopes are doomed to failure. Why? Is it because our critics are heartless, biased individuals without regard or interest for anybody but the acknowledged masters? Is it because our managers are bad, heartless, cruel? Very often, disgruntled artists and their friends are inclined to think along such lines. And a large segment of the public, always ready to associate power with corruption and not too familiar with the actual situation, will nobly side with whoever is felt to be the underdog in a specific controversy. As you may know, my distinguished predecessor here, Sir Virgil Thompson, has recently written quite a number of articles on the subject of managers. But let us not be emotional and let us consider some facts. First of all, we must realize that the technical inventions of the last few decades have brought about such a tremendous revolution in music life that we cannot even attempt to see its full portent. Above all, they have sharply reduced the need for live music. Recording, radio, and the movies have made it possible for one individual to increase his output 1,000-fold. For the first time in the history of mankind, we do not have to hear a composition played live in order to enjoy it or to play it ourselves. And our generation of musicians is the first one to feel the full impact of this monumental change. The quality of mechanical reproduction has improved so much that even the trained ear today has difficulty in determining whether a certain performance is actually live or broadcast. Well, just how much of the growth in musical appreciation can be attributed to this technical development is difficult to say. Undoubtedly, the two are more intimately connected here in the United States than anywhere else. And this connection is one of the reasons why American music life is fundamentally different from music life elsewhere. And this is important because mechanization of our music life happened just in the critical, at the critical moment when our communities were ready to adopt communal music life the way Europe had had it for a long time. You see, European concert life is mainly an outgrowth of the time of nobility, of aristocracy, which again is an outgrowth of the time of the courts. And this music life was taken over by what was called the upper classes of the bourgeoisie on a communal level. Many people here who think that state, federal support would be the answer to all our problems must know that there is very little federal support for arts in Europe. I believe federal support is not the answer. I believe civic support, communal support, support in a field where every individual citizen can, if he wants to, control the expenditures for art is the answer. And I believe we'll get there eventually. However, you see, American communal life developed entirely different from European communal life. Here in this country, there were no cities where the major part of the population would consist of the same families decade after decade, century after century. What made this country great is the certain restlessness of the population which travels around, which goes after the opportunities, which doesn't mind being here today, being in California tomorrow, and being in another part of the country next month. You see, all these signs, these symptoms of American communal life were not conducive to the establishment of a sedate, easygoing, and unruffled cultural life, communal life characteristic of European cities, inhabited, as I said, by the same people, by the same families, living on approximately the same social level for generation after generation. And incidentally, one friend of mine who came over to this country not long ago gave me a very good example of this, when he of his reaction, when he said, you know, American cities always remind me a little bit of hotel rooms. They're convenient, they're very comfortable, clean, and everything, but they're not real homey. It looks as though they're inhabited by people who are never quite sure that they're really going to stay there for any length of time. They want to have the comfort and everything, but they don't want to go into too much trouble making things real homey. And it is true that, for instance, New York is a typical example. Many people who work in New York are, in fact, much better citizens of the outlying suburbs of Westport, Connecticut, or of Orange, New Jersey, or someplace, than they are of New York City, in which they take very little interest, except that it is their place of work. Well, however, a certain settlement took place in our communities and musical institutions started to take root in the community. Symphony boards, concert committees, and so forth expanded. And as the financial resources of the original sponsors were reduced by taxes and so forth, the responsibility for the maintenance of musical institutions fell to an increasingly large number of citizens.